All right, welcome to a mailbag edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Joining me is Danny LaRue. Danny, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was very good, thank you. How was yours?
Fantastic. My sister did a Friendsgiving on Wednesday and then had the actual big turkey day on Thursday. And I've also been in a great mood because I've had the song Move On Up by Curtis Mayfield stuck in my head. Because that's the song that the Warriors play every time they win, and every time they win, I think of that song, and that song puts me in a good mood.
Yeah, it's actually, they switched from Celebration, which they used for a while, and then they switched to Move On Up sometime around the ownership change.
All right, well, let's get to the mailbag here. Let's start with, one from Pablo Yanes, or Yanes, Y-A-N-E-S. What are your thoughts on a team like Boston or other non-contenders trading for a non-star player that's still an upgrade? Can small upgrades be worthwhile moves?
Absolutely. I mean, small upgrades can definitely be good, especially in today's climate where those contracts, if they're on an existing deal, can be a really valuable thing because you can get that stability and you can get somebody who you can build around. Granted, I don't think a small upgrade with a big salary uptick is the right idea, but if you can do that without really sacrificing, whether that be in terms of picks or players, maybe they overvalue your assets, absolutely.
It's interesting that Pablo picked Boston because they are a team that, while they have a ton of depth, trades for someone where you're not really consolidating to get a great player don't really work for them that much because they already have a bunch of good players. The kind of team that can make a move like that, that I think is wise, is where you just have a big hole in your rotation. A team like Detroit, for example, where you're looking at backup point guard for them, although they're hoping that Jennings will come back, or backup center, really any of the backup positions right now for them could use an upgrade. But Boston, whoever you're going to get that's going to be available probably isn't going to help you that much. Maybe you could say that they could use another wing who can play some defense and shoot threes, but even those sorts of players are so valuable now, I'm not sure how much they'd be willing to give up for that sort of player. But yeah, I think it's just, if you're not a contender, you want to be looking at a guy who's going to be around for a while. Maybe you can look at a guy who has a contract going forward where you're giving up an expiring contract. You're saying, all right, we're willing to punt on some 2016 cap space and give the guy with the shorter contract to a team that might be willing to use that 2016 cap space. But you think, all right, you know, there's so many players out there, so much money out there that we're just not going to get as good a value as this guy already on an existing contract. That's the sort of move maybe that you might make if you're a team like Boston. But ultimately, that's sort of the blessing and the curse of where the Celtics are at right now, is there isn't anyone who's so bad that really can be upgraded realistically unless you're going to really start throwing assets into the pile.
That's a great point. And also, using some of those assets for a small upgrade theoretically takes those away from a larger upgrade. Let's say, obviously, I don't think it's likely, but let's say DeMarcus Cousins comes on the board. You know, you're going to need everything and you have to get somebody like that.
Well, before we move on to the next question, I want to tell you about DraftKings.com, our sponsor. Basketball is back, has been for a while, and you can be part of the action all season long at DraftKings, the destination for daily fantasy basketball. They are superior to the other leading brand because you can make lineup swaps later on if you have guys who are going in the late games. You can also have a little bit more flexibility in your lineup than the other leading brand. And overall, with Daily Fantasy, there are no season-long commitments, so you don't need to spend months micromanaging a roster. Every day is a brand new season. Play whenever you want. Look at the matchups for that night. Really lock in, and you can have a good time while you're watching the games. If you want to challenge your friends and coworkers, you can do that to prove that you're the superior GM to the people you know. Or you can play against fantasy players all over the country and turn your love of basketball into a payday. Use the promo code CAPSPACE, that's all one word, and easy to remember because we talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the program, at DraftKings.com, and you can play for free with your first deposit. Promo code CAPSPACE for free entry at DraftKings.com. All right, let's move on to the next one here. This is from Benjo Bautista Wensukesco. That's how it is, I think. That's my best attempt at it.
Apologize to everybody that we're going to butcher at least more than a few names.
Well, yeah, I guess that's the downside of having a listenership that's spread out a little bit, that we're not that great at the names. But this is a great question, and one that has sort of come up in some of our informal discussions as well. If the Warriors continue dominating teams the rest of the season and win 70-plus games and the championship, what do they do if Kevin Durant says he wants to go there? Should they break up one of the best teams of all time and go for it?
So, to me, I've been asked this question a few times on radio after the piece that I wrote, and I think that you can be totally justified not doing it, but for me, what you look at is the marginal difference. So let's say, as I said in the piece, that one possibility would be that functionally they trade Bogut and Iguodala for Kevin Durant. I think, to me, that's something that's worth considering, because those guys are on the wrong end of 30. Those guys are going to get worse, and they're not under contract. So for me, then, the choices there are a little bit less murky than it was before. And also, the Warriors could have the reasonable assumption that they can do more with minimum salary guys and the room exception than most teams, because not only would they be a really good team, but they would have minutes and they'd be in a place that people are happy to live. So I think they have to consider it, but at the same time, as I said at the outset, they would be totally justified in saying no and saying we're happy to do that. I think they're at a place where you would have to kind of evaluate it on the ground, but I would seriously consider it myself, because I think you might lower the ceiling a little bit, but you keep yourself a championship contender for the next, let's say, 4 to 5 years at that point.
Yeah, and that last point is the key one to me. I think actually it's quite possible if they continue to have this dominating season. I don't see them winning 70 plus necessarily, but if they continue to have this dominating season, they win the championship. I think that just the law of unintended consequences, if you have something that is certain, that is so much of an outlier already from anything else that there's been in NBA history, you know, it almost makes sense that any change that you make, even if you're adding a guy like Durant, could be a downgrade in the future, only just because you don't have the continuity. You got to learn how to integrate Steph and Durant together. And then probably the biggest issue is you're going to lose a lot of your depth. You got to probably move on from Livingston in that scenario. You're going to – Mo Spates is not going to be back, not a huge issue. And then you're probably losing either Bogut and Iguodala or Barnes. Two out of those three basically is, that's right? That's the math that would have to go if you're going to sign Durant to his $25 million max.
Yeah, other than if there's a sign-and-trade, which, of course, could change all those rules. But I'm assuming that that's not going to happen, given OKC's current stance.
Yeah, so I think you do have to do it, because when you do that, you are essentially with a nucleus of Klay, Draymond, Steph, and Durant. You're basically assuring contention for, you know, the next 3 or 4 years. Now, Durant will be... So this is his age 27 years, same thing for Steph. So they'll be, you know, they'll probably have 2-3 years left as, you know, really absolute top of the line players, you know, maybe even more or less depending on how they age. And, you know, you're still, and Azeli, that's another guy you might end up losing in that transaction as well. You know, his cap hold's only $5 million, so maybe not. Maybe they could figure out a way to hold on to him. And then you've just basically, if you're using cap space, you got the room exception and minimum contracts to fill out. Maybe you could figure out a way to make a trade and get somebody else. But the problem is that at that point, you don't really have any dead salary. Everyone else that you have on the roster still is essential. So I think that you probably have to do it. And also just from a business perspective too, I think it would just be, you know, amazing to have both of those guys. If Steph or Durant were to get injured, then you're still looking pretty good. You know, you've got a nice backstop there where you can kind of run everything through the other superstar. So I don't know. I think that even though there's probably a decent likelihood they would take a step back in the first year, you don't know whether they wouldn't do that anyway if they hung on to some of these guys who are older. So yeah, it's ultimately I would do it, but even with the expectation that you might not gel quite as quickly as the old unit did.
Yeah, and to me, the other consideration that we can talk about here that I think is really compelling is the idea that the Warriors potentially kind of finagling a sign and trade out of this. And so what that means is basically they get close to clearing the space, but then at a certain point, and Durant says, like, that's where he wants to go. And then basically at that point, you're playing a game of chicken. And so what that would enable them to do, conceptually, depending on how hard Oklahoma City tried to play it, but the Warriors would have basically have the space functionally cleared, as they could try to maybe keep Livingston, let's say, because if they did it as a sign and trade, they could keep guys like that in spades if they wanted to. And I don't know if that's going
to
happen. Yeah. I think it
would hard be hard to imagine that Oklahoma City would do a sign and trade.
It would be, and especially considering it would be, you know, directly weakening a rival and a team that you would have vengeance on. But, you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah. And the Warriors, they would be able to, it would be after the draft, so they'd be able to trade whomever they took in the 2016 draft, but then they would be prevented, other than pick swaps, from trading any picks until 2019 because they owe their 2017 unprotected to the Jazz. All right, let's. This is another one that I thought I had a pretty decent answer to. That's a short one from Will Foy. Do you think keeping blocks in bounds is more a question of ability or willingness? And there are many announcers who chastise guys for wanting to go for the showy block and blocking it into the stands and stuff. For me, when I would try to block shots, you know, I'm obviously nowhere near the talent level of actual NBA players, but I would swipe my hand very fast, especially if I was trying to get the shot in the air, because the faster you move your hand, you don't know exactly when the ball is going to be released. A lot of times you have to just sort of anticipate. And so by moving your hand fast, you can prescribe a larger arc and just have a greater area that you're covering, essentially, to where you might be able to hit the ball. Guys who block the ball when it's in guys' hands, which is pretty much exclusively what Tim Duncan, for example, who I think the Spurs recover like 80% of his blocks or something like that. And the reason for that is he barely jumps and he just blocks the shot while it's in the guy's hand. And then that's not going to go out of bounds or anything. And when it gets blocked in the guy's hand, he's got a difficult chance to recover it. And so you can do better. So it kind of depends on how you get the blocks, right? If you're a Dwight Howard guy, you're coming way over from the weak side. Same thing with Whiteside. And you're not getting there until the ball's already in the air. It is much harder to keep the ball in bounds unless you really have it sized up when you're getting the ball in the air after it's already released, the guy been released. If it's in the guy's hand, you can kind of keep it in bounds. I'm not sure whether that's something that you really can control or not. Maybe if you're just so good at shot blocking that you know you're going to get it, then you can do that. But maybe that's something to ask players about a little bit too.
Yeah, I think it's something to ask players. There might be a very narrow window. I think you're right in the vast
majority. Yeah, because there definitely are guys – sorry to break it. There definitely are guys who – you know, teams recover reliably a greater percentage of their blocks over and over again. I just don't know whether that is intentional, something that they're doing or not, or just naturally comes from the way in which they are able to block shots.
Yeah, and you hear those legends about Bill Russell and guys like that. So I think there can be a little bit of intent there, but not in every circumstance. Like, if you're trying to get the block, sometimes you're just going to get it. But, you know, maybe it's something that if it's in the back of your mind, if you have the chance, some guys just think more about that and other guys don't.
All right, this is another short one. This is from Alex Cagle. Why do we count multi-season losing streaks, Sixers, but not multi-season winning streaks, Warriors? I personally don't count either.
I don't either. I think losing or winning. I think that there's separate things. I think that when you're saying like what a record is, like if we're going by that, I think that that should be single season just because it's a different composition of people. But if you want to have that as kind of like an ancillary stat, just like for, you know, like for a if a baseball player had a hit streak that ran over multiple seasons, like it's not the same thing, but it can be something else.
And I think that teams, there's a reason that there are different seasons and a different champion for every season. And there are different players during an off season. The personnel is supposed to change. It should just start over again when you get to a new season. Like Jahlil Okafor wasn't on the Sixers last year. He shouldn't have to deal with the stain of this. And granted, you can have trades during midseason, but it's not the same thing. I mean, players, fans, everyone, the line between the seasons is a line of demarcation. I mean, you know, for the Warriors, for example, they played playoff games. So you're going to tell me that like those shouldn't count in the streak, but then you're going to go back even further than that to the regular season, then that's going to cut. That makes no sense. Just cut it off in between seasons.
And also you get into the situation for when we're talking losing streaks, that at the end of a year, sometimes that can be, you know, if you want to call it tactical, you know, there can be a reduced incentive, let's say, to win, and to carry that over doesn't seem fair because no team has that at the beginning of a season.
All right, this one is from Shafiq Islam. What is wrong with the Wizards? Danny, you're actually out in D.C. right now. You've been watching a few of their games lately. You want to take this one?
Sure. I think the biggest thing is that their defense hasn't been at the same level, and I think people will be kind of blaming that they did have turnover in the starting lineup, and that is true. But even those, you know, the lineups they did had last year that were similar to what they do last year were good. I mean, this is a team that was fifth in defense, I believe, last year. They were top five, and they're 22nd right now. I think that's a big thing. Also, of course, missing Beal. But one kind of little tidbit that I thought was really kind of telling with this is, so last year, almost all of their main lineups allowed less than 100 points per 100 possessions, so a point per possession. And the worst defender of that was their backup unit, which was terrible. But the only unit in the top 10 most played that had that with the starting core in was the lineup they're starting this year. So I thought that was a little bit funny that's the one that was aberrationally bad defensively last year. And they're worse than that this year. They gave up like 102 last year, and they're at like 106 this year. But the defense is the big part of it, and they don't have enough guys, really. They don't have enough creators, let's say, on that team to overcome that kind of a backslide on defense.
Yeah, the offense isn't much better either. They are now 26th in offense. I think they finished last year at 19th. The hope was that this more free-flowing style was going to open things up, but John Wall in particular just has not been playing as well. I think everyone thought, wow, he was really primed for a breakout year. This could be a time where he, you know, gets into the conversation as being, you know, a top 10 player for sure in the NBA. And instead, he's turning the ball over on 20% of his possessions, which is totally miserable. Not really shooting any better than he had been before. And yeah, as you said, Beal being out has not helped. But yeah, I mean, and usually they could at least rely on their defense to keep things close. And now, you know, the defense is kind of, almost a bottom 10 unit when it's been really an excellent defense for these last 3 years. And part of that you could say is Nene and Gortat. Maybe you can say that, you know, just not having that beef up front. Or you can just say that guys like Gortat and Nene, who are in their 30s, have declined. That Wall, you know, has had an even bigger load, and that's part of the reason he hasn't been able to be as great this year. And that Otto Porter, while he kind of has the length to be a stopper, you know, doesn't necessarily have like the intelligence as much. So I don't know. It's their numbers are very, very concerning, and you cannot put all of it at all at the feet of the fact that Beal, you know, has missed a few games, because even when he's been in there, they've not played particularly well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it certainly hasn't helped, but it is not the reason. So yeah, it is concerning because a lot of this isn't a team that you expect to have internal improvement in the way that they're, you know, they're mostly kind of where they are, and they had a lot of continuity. I mean, they're playing a different lineup, but they have almost all these players were on the team last year.
Is this a cautionary tale that small ball isn't for everybody?
Small ball when you play Chris Humphries at the four isn't for everyone.
Yeah, let's see what happens now. Jared Dudley actually started for them today. They played a little better, although they ultimately lost to the Raptors and was a pretty inglorious defeat on that Corey Joseph three-pointer. But, I think just playing well at home against the Raptors, who had been going pretty well, is at least something to feel a little bit better about. So I don't know. I mean, I still think I want to see what they look like too when Allen Anderson comes back. But yeah, I mean, just their individual guys haven't been playing well enough on either end right now. And you hope that these guys have pretty good histories that maybe they'll get back to it. And you know, people have talked about, oh, is Randy Whitman, like, are they tuning him out? I mean, he's acquiesced. They're playing the way that theoretically, like, everyone would want to be playing if you're the Wizards. So, you know, if they are tuning him out, that's certainly probably pretty unfair to him, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
All right, next question here. This is from Liam Hall. Do you believe Memphis can come in fourth in the West?
Can? Yes. Will? Probably not. I mean, I don't think that, as you've mentioned before, I think you talked about this with Kevin Pelton, their defense isn't what it looked like the last couple of years. And you think about this as a team that won 55 last season, and that was largely carried by having a truly dominant defense. I think that the fourth spot in the West is more gettable, I think, than we both expected it to be at the beginning of the year. But I don't see Memphis as being the team that really has the combination of talent, and they can't, like, knock people out of the gym. And what that does is, when your offense isn't like that, is that gives teams kind of the ability, that makes it so that you never really salt games all the way away. And they can get blown out for the same reason. You know, they've had a couple of those this year. So I think it's possible. I mean, there's a team that won 55 last year, but I wouldn't call it likely in any way, shape, or form.
All right, so I think we can agree, Warriors, Spurs, Thunder, no way Memphis catches either of those teams. Memphis is at 9-8 right now. They're actually fifth. The Thunder, Spurs, and Warriors are the only teams in double-digit wins right now. So who are some of the other teams that they're competing with? The Clippers, who blew out the Pelicans last night. You could say maybe the Jazz and the Mavericks. Those are probably the only team. I mean, the Wolves are also at 8-8. I don't know that I'm ready to put them in that kind of conversation yet. So, you know, I give the Grizz, like, you know, a 10% chance. I mean, I still think the Clippers have so much talent that it would be difficult for them not to be fourth in the West.
Yeah, I mean, really the way that happens is injury. And I don't think that a team like the Rockets or anybody like that could make it all the way back, but we're still early enough that basically what you're saying with the Grizzlies, as you said, there are three teams at the top are probably going to be there, is, are they going to be that? Can they beat the random variance of whatever team ends up being pretty hot? And what's the chance that it's them? And I think the chances it's them are a little bit lower just because of the way their team is formatted. And the chances of anybody in, let's say, the five teams around them to have, you know, that crazy stretch is, it's entirely possible.
Yeah, and the Grizz are still at a negative 4.0 net rating over the course of the year. Granted, some of that is still those huge losses early in the season, but those kind of count too. And even over their last 10 games, they're only at a 1.5 net rating. That's not going to be good enough, I don't think, to get the fourth seed, even if they can continue that level of play for the rest of the year.
Where do you want to go next?
You want to pick one?
Sure. Let's go to Anthony Canton III. With a couple of West teams struggling record-wise, so staying on the same theme, do you believe the Pelicans have a better chance of making the playoffs now?
As opposed to, I guess, you know, a week and a half ago when Kevin and I wrote them off when they were 1-11,
That would be a fair interpretation.
What he's talking about. Yeah, I think so. You know, AD continuing to just get injured all the time doesn't really help you too much. Again, I think there's still, you know, I don't know. It's part of me wants to say they have a better chance, but in addition to the fact that some of the West teams we thought were going to be good are struggling, there are more teams that have stayed in the conversation for kind of finishing around 500 than we might have thought, too. You know, you've got teams like Phoenix, Sacramento, Dallas, who I think you and I at the start of the year both had out of the playoffs. You know, even the Nuggets, I mean, I think they're going to fall out of it pretty quickly here, but, you know, they still have a better record than the Pelicans. I mean, there's really only one truly awful team that you can write off right now in the West. I mean, I would say Denver probably too, but and that would be the Lakers, and maybe you could say Portland too, but they have so many teams to pass that you know, I don't think are going to be terrible, that I think it's probably, I don't think it has much to do with the rest of the league so much as it's just that they have started playing a little bit better. That's really the important thing.
Yeah, I ballparked it. I wrote a little tweet on the 25th. I ran the numbers a little bit, and they needed, at that time, they've lost since then, to win 60% of their games to get to 44, which is my current guess for what the number will be, which is lower
than
it's been.
I'm going to say it'll actually be a little lower. I'm going to say it's like 42, but yeah.
So then it, you know, probably that's probably like 57, 58% anyway. But yeah, I think that it's a little bit better just because I think that they can win more. I'm more confident that they can win without Tyreek Evans than I was before. And while they expect to get him back, you know, being able to win without one or more of your top guys is important. However, of course, you always worry about Davis. I mean, you get a little bit gun shy now, especially after what happened last night, even though it ended up not being bad, you know, missed him for the rest of that game and so on and so forth. But I think that the real challenge with them, as you said, is that while it is maybe a little bit thinner, there are just so many teams that, as I said before with Memphis, like the random variants, like a couple of those teams are going to do really well. And if you're the Pelicans, if three of those teams, let's say, do well, then that could push it harder. That could make it harder to get in.
All right. Another one here. This is from a frequent questioner and good fan, Yusing Chen. He basically, it's a long question, but he's basically asking, how do you defend a dribble handoff? And teams have gone to dribble handoffs. I mean, I think we know what that is. Basically, a guy, a big will get the ball at the elbow, maybe out more towards the wing. He will hand the ball off to a guard, and it almost functions essentially as a pick and roll at that point on the handoff, because he kind of can set a screen on the guard's man, and then, you know, the big essentially has to help out, and then the screener can roll to the rim, and it's a very similar action to a pick and roll. And it has the advantage of it's very difficult to ice it or down it, because you have the guy coming off, you know, usually starting from down low, coming back, looping back around to get the handoff, coming from a different area where you can't keep the guy when he doesn't have the ball from using the screen the way you can when he does have the ball, and you kind of know that it's coming. So it is a play that we've seen pretty much every team running now, and it is very effective.
Yeah, it is effective. And also for me, like, you can see some guys have trouble a little bit with the transition, but if you can, you get moving in a kind of a different way on a handoff than you can off a screen, especially because you don't start with the ball in your hands. And so I think that you're right that it limits what you can do. But at the same time, you know, if the big can kind of hold it for a couple seconds, then I think that you can still handle it in some of the ways. You just don't have all of the options on the table.
Yeah, there are a couple of ways that you can deal with it. One is you can – three really come to mind. One is – and the Wizards were very effective on this, and Joakim Noah, who was using a lot of this stuff in – the 2014 season with the Bulls, is you just really have the big pressure up the big man. Don't let him make the catch. If he does, make him step further out. And then once he catches it, you're swatting at the ball, you're chesting up. Usually a big guy, you know, if it's think like an Andrew Bogut or a Noah, there's not necessarily a downside to pressuring up, at least with that individual, because he's not going to put the ball on the floor and drive all the way to the rim and burn you that way. So you can kind of pressure up with impunity and, you know, kind of get your hand in there, prevent the handoff. The other part of it, too, is in a lot of the DHO game, if the guy guarding the small kind of sells out to prevent the DHO, then you can get a quick back door on him. That's what Bogut and Noah like to throw. And so if you're pressuring those guys up, they're going to be uncomfortable. They're not going to be able to just pick guys out and make that pass. So that's one way to deal with it. The other one, which we kind of talked about already, is for, you know, you're almost icing the guy without even him having the ball, where you're just getting in front of him, preventing him from taking the handoff. I mean, if you think of it more, it's usually these DHOs will take place on the side, on the wing. And so what you're trying to do is you get the handoff and get middle the way you would on a side pick and roll, but you normally can't because everyone ices it now. So if you're the defender, you can just deny the actual handoff. The problem there is that then the guy can cut back door pretty easily, either before he ever even tries to get the handoff, or, which you'll see the Warriors do a lot, he'll just continue to the middle as the guy kind of sells out to deny the pass on the handoff. Then he gets behind him and he can loop back around and get it going down the lane after he's been denied the handoff. So that's one aspect of that you can do as well. And then another thing that you can do too is, and this is why a guy like Bogut can be or Noah can be a liability, you have to run it with a guy who's a good shooter. Because if he's not a good shooter, then the defense can just go under the handoff the same way you would on a screen and just meet him on the other side. But you can't do that with guys like Steph Curry or Klay, because they will pull up a lot of times behind the three-point line if you lose contact with them. So it's that shooting that really makes the dribble handoff game so good. Either that, and then also guys like Parker can be really hard to guard, and a guy who does this in Europe really well is Vasilije Spanoulis, who they sprint out just so hard to get the handoff that the guy's just inevitably going to be behind and out of position. So there's really watching the way the teams are guarding that is just as important now as the way they're guarding pick and roll defense.
When you were saying that, the thing that I kept thinking about is how DHOs would work if it was Durant and Curry. It would just be filth.
Yeah, and you could always switch them too if you need to as well. That's another way you can deal with them. But it is a very effective play, and you can use it to get the guy, the defense out of position much more easily than a pick and roll that everyone knows is coming.
Okay, so I'll do one that we're going to have a short answer for now on, which is from Will Foy, which is who would make your guys all aesthetic and anti-aesthetic teams? And then I'll let you answer that.
Well, so we're going to do a full podcast on that. We're trying to work out who we're going to get to judge it, but basically Danny and I are going to draft all aesthetic and anti-aesthetic teams, and we're trying to find someone who will do a good job of judging which of us drafted the better team. So that'll be a fun episode to do, hopefully coming, you know, in these next couple of weeks here or so. All right, let's see here. Go ahead.
One from Charlie Burry, which is, or Barry, either way, is would Kobe Bryant be a top 15 EuroLeague player right now?
The answer is no.
No.
And the reason for that is that he's so damaging and would shoot so often that there's really no way. And he doesn't have the ability and the explosion to even beat guys who are kind of mediocre defenders there. And I would say, true, that most EuroLeague teams have at least one guy who would be an okay defender on the wing in the NBA. It's just you don't have that many of those guys. And, yeah, Kobe is not someone who moves off the ball. I mean, I think the one thing that might help him in the EuroLeague is that, you know, even the stars don't play as much. You know, they'll play 25 minutes a game, maybe 30, and the games aren't as often either. Although, you know, having to make him go through practice all the time probably wouldn't be too good either. So, I mean, I think he'd be better. But, you know, the EuroLeague is legit. There are definitely, I mean, if you think about it this way, that Kobe Bryant has been the most damaging player in the NBA this year. And then there are certainly at least 15 NBA players playing in the EuroLeague right now. So, who, if they played in the NBA, would be less damaging than him. If he played the same way that he's been playing, yeah, there's no way he could be a top 15 player.
Yeah, it would smooth some of his weaknesses, but I still think, I mean, top 15 EuroLeague player, there are more than 15 teams. So it's like, would he be the best player on a EuroLeague team? And the answer is, on a majority of teams, no.
Yeah, although there are definitely some EuroLeague teams that aren't that good. But,
for sure. But, I mean, there are certainly teams that have multiple guys that I would take over Kobe right now.
Okay, here's one. What is the one realistic trade? This is from Matthew Abshire. The one realistic trade you'd like to see happen to make a team more enjoyable to watch?
So this was actually strangely hard for me because I'm somebody who, while I love fake trades, I really try to focus when somebody asks for it to be realistic on doing that. And
I know, I was really sad that he put in the word realistic. I was hoping we'd get to see you run wild on this one.
Well, so for me, my logic process was a lot of the enjoyable to watch is point guard. So I was kind of thinking, okay, well, who is an available point guard who's not really being used? And then what is the team that could use him? And what I thought of eventually was, the core is Beno Udrih going to the Jazz. And the Jazz actually have cap space right now, but the larger version that I did was to accomplish another goal, which I know exists, which is for the Heat to get below the luxury tax. And so the way I thought of doing that was that you have Beno, you have Birdman, and then
this is way too realistic. So the centerpiece of this trade is Beno Udrih?
No, the centerpiece is Josh McRoberts.
Oh, okay.
And so they get those guys. They send them to Utah. Utah sends back Trevor Booker, so they get a guy who's not as good, but, you know, can service and is on an expiring contract. And then you just add guys like Christopher Johnson to balance the numbers to balance the numbers enough to make the trade workable. And if they want Jeff Withey or somebody like that, they can do that. But that idea, not only does it make Utah a lot better, I think it makes them a lot deeper. It allows Trey Lyles to develop, but it also gets Miami to one of their goals without really doing too much to hurt their depth.
Well, I agree with you that Utah could use an upgrade as a third big. I do think that McRoberts would be an excellent fit there because he could play alongside either Favors or Gobert very well, space the floor a little bit. I mean, McRoberts is on a really good contract for the next 3 years at $5 million. Although his individual stats have not been good, he has been the Heat have played very well with him on the floor. I don't know that they would be willing to give him up. I think that would be a pretty significant blow, but I do agree with you that he would be great on the Jazz. So mine actually is probably a little bit less realistic.
Yes.
And it starts with the Atlanta Hawks, because I think they're ultimately going to need to make a decision between Jeff Teague and Dennis Schroeder. Teague, I think, will be 29 by the time his contract expires at the end of 2017. That is the same time that Schroeder will become a restricted free agent. So that means you're basically going to have to pay starting point guard money to both of those guys if you assume that Schroeder is going to develop. So I think that they might want to move on from Schroeder. And they have a few, they have a pick coming from the Wolves that will probably get conveyed from the Adrian Payne trade. But they don't really have a ton of young prospects other than Schroeder, who plays the same position as a guy who's been playing at close to an all-star level in Teague. So I thought that they could maybe move Schroeder to a team that, with Jrue Holiday sort of uncertain in his health status, could really use a point guard and someone who would be unbelievable running pick and roll with Anthony Davis, because Davis is going to turn into one of those Dirk Nowitzki guys that you just can't leave on a pick and pop. And so Schroeder could get right to the rim. I mean, we've seen what that Mavs system has done for guys like, you know, J.J. Barrett. Darren Williams, of course, is having a renaissance. Monte Ellis, you know, Schroeder could sort of be like the point guard version of Ellis. And Schroeder was able to be awesome playing with Dirk on the German national team in a very similar role. So I think he would be awesome on New Orleans. And, you know, maybe New Orleans gives up their 2016 first-round pick and, you know, some other flotsam to make the salaries match. That probably, and maybe, you know, if you're the Hawks, you just say, look, you know, I realize Schroeder is pretty good, but, you know, his value is never going to be that high playing behind Teague. You know, we're a team that's kind of in win now mode, but, you know, if we let it go any further with Schroeder, his value is going to decline because he could almost be a free agent. So we have to make the move on him now. And then you hope that the Pels, you know, you demand it unprotected if you're Atlanta, and then you hope that the Pels kind of continue to not play that well and that pick ends up being the top 10 pick this year.
Just for fun, if you were Dell Demps, would you do that trade with it unprotected?
If I were Dell Demps, if I were the general manager of the New Orleans Pelicans who had a secure future, I would probably not do that trade. If I were Dell Demps and I had a bunch of pressure and I knew that Jrue Holiday and Tyreke Evans' health was questionable, maybe I'd think about it. But I don't know. I mean, it depends how much you believe in Schroeder, and I'm not as much of a Schroeder believer personally as others are, but I think he is a very exciting player, and that playing in New Orleans with Gentry, with AD, with Ryan Anderson, also to space the floor, that would be the absolute height of his powers, because his biggest weakness, he can get to the basket very easily, but actually finishing over people who are there is difficult. But he's so fast that he can beat the help there. That's when he can score. And when you're playing with such a space floor, that would really eliminate his biggest weakness, because you're just not going to have him finishing over a challenge nearly as often.
That's a great point. I actually thought about fake Schroeder trades originally with this. One thing though.
And I don't think the Hawks would necessarily give up on him anyway. I would make that trade almost because I don't believe in him as much, and I'm sure that they believe in him more than I do.
Yeah, and I would fight like all hell for a top two protection, let's say, or something like that, and I'd get it, and you'd get it. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily get like five, but if you could do
top three would probably be.
Yeah. So one question that I thought was interesting, and I kind of want to hear your answer before mine, though I have an answer for it, is from Ethan Kearns, which was referencing the great Bobby Marks, and he's talked about how mid-December the trade market can heat up because that's when guys can be traded. And so what Ethan asked was, which teams will be buyers and sellers, and who do you predict will be moved?
Well, I think you always start with these sorts of questions trying to think of what are the category of guys who could be moved, number one. And a lot of times that's guys with expiring contracts on teams that are out of it and are just not looking to, you know, you don't want to lose a guy for nothing, so you trade him. You know, those are the sorts of guys, 2016 free agents on teams that are probably realizing that they are out of contention, those are the guys that I think you end up moving. And then which teams are buyers and sellers? Well, we talked about those are obviously the type of teams that would be sellers. The buyers are teams that have a hole, like we talked about in that Celtics question, that could easily be upgraded to where you can say, all right, if we could just get this position to average, because I don't think you're not going to see better than average guys, I think, on the move this year, unless the landscape really changes for some of these teams. So you'd say, all right, what are teams with a huge hole? And if we could just upgrade this to average, then we would be in much, much better shape. Those are the sorts of transactions I think will happen.
My kind of theory, I guess you could call it, with the coming opening of this is that I think that there will actually be very few teams that consider themselves sellers. I think that teams are going to be optimistic because right now the eighth spot, let's say, looks more
gettable. Yeah, there just aren't that many crappy teams right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So and some of these guys are getting injured.
Like, if you're Orlando, are you sitting there going, oh, we're sellers now? I mean, but what I think could be very interesting, just given the nature of GMs and the relationships they have, is we could see some moves which are kind of seen maybe as kind of lateral moves or challenge trades in that way of where it's like neither team is really going after a different motivation. Maybe they just think they can get a better fit. And those are, for me, the most interesting trades. I think those are the ones that are kind of the most fun to consider, as much as we enjoy the Sixers-Kings type of stuff. I think that those kinds of moves could be possible this year because you can do that while maintaining optimism.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So are there any names that really come to mind for you?
Not really. I think that we've talked about Lou Williams a couple times.
And especially right at December 15th, which seemed like it was kind of the thrust of this question.
Yeah, I think Lou Williams is a guy who makes a lot of sense, but I also don't know exactly where would be the perfect fit for him. I think that he's a player that makes sense to move. We've talked about that a little bit. And the other hard part about this in terms of thinking about it is that most teams are going to want to maintain their 2016 space. I think there's a real market advantage for any team that is willing to shed part of that or all of that. And I don't know personally who those teams are, but if you can get a team, I'm trying to think of a good example. Like, it would be the equivalent of Brooklyn a couple of years ago, but if you can get a team that really wants to squeeze every inch of space, like let's say they have an equivalent of Josh McRoberts and you're like, oh, well, we need to get that. If you can get the player like that on a what would be a ostensibly good contract, those are the types of moves that I think a good active GM would be looking for.
All right, so here are some names looking at my free agent list, guys that I think could be moved that wouldn't really necessarily serve a purpose. Gerald Henderson, I think, is someone who could be moved, certainly. And I think he might help, a team like the Bulls that's really struggling to find even a second wing who can be competent on both ends, not even, a third wing. Maybe it'll be a third wing once Dunleavy comes back. So there are plenty of the Wizards are another team. They want to play small. The Wizards don't want to necessarily take on anything past 2016, but maybe they offer, a second round pick for Henderson, and he's another guy who's tough, can defend, help them kind of play a little bit more small ball. I think, let's see, Joakim Noah. What about him? I think that maybe the Bulls might realize that he, is nearing kind of being done. They need to shake things up, get better on offense. I mean, they're like the 28th, 29th offense as of this recording. And you'd say, all right, we're going to just get him out of the rotation. Maybe there's a team that might give up a first rounder for him. I'm not sure who that team necessarily would be, but maybe he's got enough name recognition around the league still.
I'd be fielding calls on Noah and Powell and just seeing if you can get a team basically to make a mistake. And you never know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a Bulls team that's what, 9-5 right now or something like that. So, I mean, they, especially Powell, they can't, I mean, they kind of need Powell. The offense has been so bad, that you're going to have to find a way to, get some offense if you're going to get rid of him. They need him at this point. So let's see. I mean, there's not that many guys. Hibbert is obviously someone too, but he's a big enough salary. And I also, we sort of tried to find a spot for him before, I think, and there aren't that many teams that could use him as an upgrade, at least in the starting lineup. And then I don't like him. I like him actually more as a starter because a lot of teams go small enough on the bench units that he's not necessarily going to have someone to guard. Most teams at least start a conventional center for him to match up with. I think Tyler Zeller is someone maybe who could be traded. You know, he could help some teams as well. You know, he's going to be a restricted free agent. Yeah, I mean, not a ton else that's out there, though, that really comes to mind. Joe Johnson could be another one, but I think he's more likely a buyout candidate than a trade candidate. And
we're not at the point yet where, like, some of the guys that teams maybe they regret the signing. There aren't, first of all, there aren't a ton of those because we talked about how last year's market dynamics were crazy. But, like,
exactly.
Aaron Baines, let's say, like, for example, like, that's not the right time, theoretically, to move
and
we're dissatisfied.
And I mean, still, if we talk about it right now, how many of the contracts that were signed last summer look bad right now? Maybe Oshik and Baines. Can you think of any other ones?
Agenza.
That because, yeah, I mean, maybe, Derek but he's
Williams,
so small.
Maybe. But
yeah,
it's not a big
well,
deal.
Yeah, Derek Williams has what? He has a player option
right? Next
year. Yeah, $5 million. Yeah, that's not looking good. He started off well, and now he's pretty much like out of the rotation.
Well, and the other group of guys that I was thinking of with challenge trades, and the guy who came into my head with this is James Young, is the idea of like if maybe you could just buy low on somebody a little bit early right now, kind of the equivalent of the Maurice Harkless trade, but just doing it a little bit earlier, maybe a team like Boston would do that for a more established player.
Yeah. Yeah, but I really, there are not a ton of guys that really jump out, and maybe as we get more clarity on who's actually going to be in the race and who's going to be out. I mean, part of the same reason that there's not that much of a trade market is because there aren't that many awesome free agents either, you know, and like, and so many teams are going to have space that they're, or at least another thing too is that you probably have some of these teams like New Orleans, maybe Houston that, yeah, maybe they're not that good this year, but they came in with big expectations and they're not going to just punt on guys. You know, New Orleans is, I don't see them trading Ryan Anderson. They're going to want to hold on to his bird rights and try to just be better next year, even if they ultimately do disappoint.
Yeah, and that's also true with the guys that are going to be restricted free agents for even more obvious reasons because they have match rights. I mean, I think you could see guys like Tyler Zeller move, but like I had thought about just how interesting it would be if somebody, let's say like Myers Leonard, when he gets healthy, if he could be on the market, but I don't really think that's going to happen.
All right, this is another one that's interesting. This is from Mikhail Mukin. Are you going to review the Pacers' off-season grade, and are they legit contenders? So what did we give them for an off-season grade? Do you remember? I think it was like, I can't remember which one it was, but we were in the like kind of, it was somewhere between like C-plus and like D-plus or something like that, right?
Yeah, I think it was in that range. And I think that something you need to separate is a team being successful and a team being successful because of their off-season. And I think that they're a team that, with Paul George back, I mean, he's the big reason they're doing well. They did absolutely nothing this offseason related to Paul George. He was under contract. He stayed under contract. They did it. The guy they drafted, Myers Leonard, is very good. I was super high on him.
No.
Miles Turner. I had the right thing in my head, Miles Turner. But so he's been good when he's been there, but he's been hurt for this last little while. So, I mean, the guys that are propelling them, CJ Miles, the guys that are doing well for them primarily, aren't the guys that they just picked up.
Well, that's right. So, I mean, we look at what their success has been. They're now second in defense, 11th in offense, per Basketball Reference. And they are actually, you know, expected one loss of 11-4, which is outstanding. Great differential. A lot of that is just George has been killing it just beyond what anybody's expectations could have been. I mean, part of the reason that I initially took the Pacers under when we did that first podcast back in the beginning of October, we hadn't seen George in the preseason. I thought, all right, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. I want to make sure that he's back. Then when he was, I said, all right, I'll take them to be the eighth seed. They're looking a lot better than that so far right now. But let's take a look at the guys that they got, right? Are they doing well because of Monte Ellis with his 12.9 PER, 466 true shooting percentage, and not a very good defender? Those are his like box score stats that he's supposed to be good at. No. Are they doing well because of Jordan Hill, 471 true shooting percentage? Nah, probably not. Are they doing well because of Chase Budinger? He's been okay, but you know, I wouldn't say that necessarily either. It's actually pretty remarkable what they've done when you consider that. You know, they don't have a ton of guys other than Miles and George who are kind of playing offensively above what their preseason expectations would have been. But, you know, it's just Frank Vogel and, you know, Paul George is a great defender too. Jan Mahimi is having a wonderful defensive season. So when you consider all that, you know, the defense is just as good as it ever was.
Yeah, I looked it up. I gave them a C-. I think that's about right. You know, I don't feel too much guilt about that. And the answer to are they contender is, I mean, if they could stay healthy, they have a chance of beating Cleveland. I mean, but I don't consider them a serious title contender right now, just like I don't consider any team other than Cleveland the East one. So I think they're in a good spot. I think they're you know, about right. But I don't think that they're in that, let's say, in the Cleveland, Oklahoma City, Spurs, Warriors tier. Not at all.
And maybe where we are being a little bit too harsh was that they dumped Hibbert. And I think at the time we were saying, well, wouldn't you rather just have this Hibbert expiring contract than, you know, who they ended up signing, Jordan Hill and LaVoy Allen to his contract. And LaVoy is having a terrible individual statistical season, but they've played great with him on the floor. And I think when you look especially at where they are in offense right now, that some of those guys have done much better because they don't have Hibbert, although, you know, Hibbert has looked better offensively on the Lakers, ironically enough. But, you know, we've talked many times about how he's kind of just a suck offensively in terms of the fact that he just doesn't really have anywhere that he can stand and avoid gumming up the works and, you know, can't really run pick and roll. So maybe we're underrating the positive effect of just getting rid of him. But I still think that even doing that, you know, that Ellis contract is going to come back to bite him. And remember, too, the offseason grade, it's not just based on the first month of the season. It's based on the contracts you handed out that are going to go on for 4 years when Monte Ellis is 33 years old and he's, you know, been terrible even this year when he's 29.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that's something that's key to mention in this is, yeah, you're looking at how it affects the future and all that. And so, yeah, we'll see where it goes. Do you have any that you really want? I have one that we can do.
This is from Billy Bissell. May not be a real name, but it is Facebook. So he at least decided to call himself that on Facebook. Why do you hate CAPTCHA? Is it difficult for you to prove that you're not a robot? Some of my friends have actually would probably laugh at that and say, yes, it is very difficult for me to prove it. activate laugh protocol. But no, I think it's just annoying. And, you know, probably like maybe one quarter of the time it doesn't really work. And the reason he's bringing this up is because that's always what I say for SeatGeek is it's that's something that we say is a virtue for SeatGeek is that you don't have to enter it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just kind of dumb and annoying. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but, you know, it probably saves you 25 seconds every time you're trying to buy a ticket to not have to do that.
Yeah, and it's a whole nother interaction they have to do. And, I mean, I could, of course, talk about CAPTCHAs for a long time considering my old line of work. But I think that it, you know, it's nice that you don't have to deal with it. And really, for me, what that means is that it's a different kind of process. And you know that you're buying tickets in a more direct way. It's not like when you're kind of doing the lottery, let's say, type thing of how people buy tickets like right as they're released. You know, you have more choice in the process. You're choosing specific seats at that price. And, you know, with something like DealScore, you get an advantage there too.
Excellent. All right. Well, so that's both DraftKings and SeatGeek got a little extra plug for their money as well. So, you know, thanks for that question. I can't believe that we decided to pick that one. And also here, we never got to the second part of Mikhail's question. I realized, are the Pacers legit contenders? I mean, what is that, for the championship?
No. I talked about it a little bit, and I think that's where it was too.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, they're legit contenders to lose to the Cavs in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah, certainly.
And you know, maybe if the Cavs suffer an injury, they do have. I will say this: if the Cavs don't have Love or Irving, I think the Pacers could actually give them a pretty good series because with Paul George, other than maybe Kawhi, they might have the best guy to prevent this whole. All right, LeBron, I'm just going to back you down and force a double team, and then we're going to pass it to somebody. Offense that they kind of devolved to in the Eastern Conference playoffs a lot last year. But I think as long as the Cavs are healthy, I do not put the Pacers in their class. And also, I think they're going to regress a little bit. I don't think that George especially can just keep up this level of jump shooting that he's had so far. All right. We got time for maybe one more here. You want to pick one? All right. Why don't we each do one? How about that?
Okay. So one that I had was from Stuart. I'll say O'Keele. For the Jazz to reach the potential of the season, I, the writer, think they need a starting caliber point guard. who could they get that also fits their timeline, or should they stand pat and wait for Exum to return next year?
I think they should stand pat and wait for Exum to return next year. The timeline, as you mentioned, is pretty important. And this is a Jazz team that, you know, could they've taken a step back lately, but I still think that they could have the talent to get as high as like fifth in the West this year if it all breaks right for them. But do you really want to give up future assets to, you know, this is certainly not a championship team still. So do you want to give up future assets to just get a little bit better this year? And then Exum, who's the number five pick, and they, you know, they still have Burke too, has actually had a pretty decent year up until recently, and then he's been hurt a little bit. But I think they're getting enough there, and even Neto has been, you know, he's been an okay, like 10 minutes a game guy. Let's see. I mean, if you get to the point where they're still 500 and all those guys are floundering, maybe, but there's not anyone who makes a great upgrade. As we mentioned, the free agent class is weak. So of the guys who like might be free agents that teams would want to get rid of, there aren't that many of those. And it's especially weak at point guard. So I think a big part of the problem is just that there aren't that many great trade upgrades unless you're willing to surrender a ton of assets. And then if you do that, that's going to be a guy who's making a lot of money. You got to send back matching salary. Now you're going to have that invested in a guy who's going beyond this year in a contract. You're blocking Exum. Burke has even made some strides. Maybe he can get to being, you know, at least a lower level starter guy. So I think they hold pat. I would be fine with that.
Yeah, I think holding pat is the right answer, especially because, let's say, the guy that I mentioned in a conversation with Ben Golliver early in the year, before the season even started, was like, hey, if things go really badly in Phoenix, Eric Bledsoe would be awesome there. But Eric Bledsoe's done amazing. They're not going to move him for anything realistic. So, you know, it basically, as we've talked about before, it's like, if somebody makes a mistake, you're there. And one of the huge benefits with Utah is that they have a little bit of cap space. So they don't have to do some of the same tricks that other teams have to do, but they don't need to feel any urgency. So that actually gives them some leverage, because they can say, we're good now, we're going to make the playoffs, this isn't our year anyway. You know, like there's no trade that exists where they would contend for a title this year. So if another team is restless or they want to clear some space because they think they're going to get somebody next year, then you listen to them and you see if they're going to make a mistake. But you don't have to be scared or be anxious, because they are where they are, and they should be thrilled with that considering how young their team is.
All right, I got two more. Let's do the first one. Julian Sokol. That last name reminds me of the unemployment officer that George goes to see in The Boyfriend. I think her last name is Sokol. Remember, he goes out with her daughter so that she'll like continue giving him the unemployment benefits. Anyway, I'm sure you're not related to that fictional character. But are the Spurs hoping to mimic the Grizzlies from last year's playoff series versus Golden State, minus a bad shooter on the floor? Can that work? I don't think they are trying to mimic the Grizzlies at all.
No, they're their own team. I mean, their offense is functional and good, and they have a lot of talent there. And also, the specific defenders that San Antonio has are very different. And I think that the Spurs model might be the best way to beat the Warriors, but they need that guy to penetrate and puncture the defense, and we have to still see if Tony Parker or Manu, whoever, can do that in a seven-game series.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, this is a Spurs team that has relied more on isolation play, especially through Leonard, who is shooting an amazing percentage on jump shots but hasn't really been creating that much for others. Aldridge, another guy who kind of likes to get his work done in the mid post. The Warriors are a team that switches a ton, that takes away a lot of ball movement at all. I think that'll be one of the very interesting subplots of that series, is how much are the Spurs going to be able to move the ball and get open shots against the Warriors team, and how much are the Warriors going to be able to force them into playing a more isolation style with their switching, with their ball denial. So that's something I would look at. But I mean, the Spurs have so much better a two-way player, so much better of a system. I mean, they've got two guys who are better at creating one-on-one than anyone that on Memphis. Another stylistic thing too is that the Spurs are really going to try to bludgeon in the post. Tim Duncan, not really a guy who gets his own offense posting up much anymore, except in like the biggest mismatches. Aldridge will do that a little bit, but he's not a guy who's going to seal deep in the paint that often. And then the Spurs very rarely go to the offensive boards. They prioritize getting back on defense, and that was always a big thing for Memphis. And then the Spurs also never foul, and Memphis, you know, fouls a fair amount as well. So that's I would say no, I don't really see that much in common with the two teams other than the fact that they both start two traditional bigs. That's about it.
Yeah, and also the Spurs are really deep generally, and so I think that's something they have that Memphis doesn't, because the Warriors killed Memphis with the second units from what I remember.
All right, so the last one, let's see, what do we have here? This is from Narbe Avanesian. How would you turn around the Nets? Well, you know, I think we're out of time.
I mean,
well, thanks for listening to the show. You know, if you want to support the, yeah, I mean, it's that maybe that we could make that our own show during the offseason. I don't think we have enough time for that in one mailbag. And frankly, you know, they're a team that, I will try to give some legitimate thoughts on that at some point, but they are in such a bad way. They probably have the most hopeless future. I mean, maybe you could look at their cap space, but you know, if this were 2017, maybe you would feel a little bit better about their cap space. But right now, just with their next three draft picks owed in either unprotected or swapped to the Celtics, they're probably in the most hopeless position I can remember a team being in American team sports for a while, or since a while.
When we get sponsored by an adult beverage, I think that would be an excellent podcast to do with you under their banner.
Also, yeah, all right. Narva, we're
For people, actually, so Kevin Pelton does chats every week with ESPN, and every once in a while, if I happen to be around, I put in questions under fake names just because I'm amused, and sometimes he answers them. And I actually asked one that is not under my name, but it was actually me asking if the Nets were the most hopeless sort of circumstance in North American sports. You can read his answer there too.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. If you want to support the podcast, use that cap space code on DraftKings to have a fun time playing some one-day fantasy basketball. SeatGeek, of course, another great sponsor of the show. You can leave us an iTunes review or rating. That has been instrumental in our success, and we really appreciate all the nice things that people have said about that. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA, and Danny is Danny LaRue, and we will talk to you all next time.